can go and put a title on it. It's going to be Leadership and Entrepreneurial Lessons from Bracius and from Baba Mencia. Okay, so we're going to go and see a little bit of the combination of several of the things. The Masora, how it goes and helps inform some of the mindset we have to bring to these things when we are exerting some leadership muscles, when we're trying to be entrepreneurial and bring that mindset. And so we're going to go and bring these things together in terms of the Torah side of this, the Masora. Some of it is recent stuff that entrepreneurship has discovered that actually Chazal knew long ago. And so we'll be able to see a little bit of the ties of the past into the future. If entrepreneurship is going and creating the future, it's based on the backbone of the past for us. And so that's what we're going to be going and delving into. I very much want to have a bit of a shakla vitaria between us also, especially late at night. It's much better to be able to go and have back and forth rather than just a speaking head. I don't know how much you guys know about entrepreneurship. Has anyone heard that there's a high rate of failure within startups? Okay, so there's very little data on entrepreneurship, but I hear that that's a common one. That's made its way around there. That high risk, does anyone want to go and be a founder, an entrepreneur? Okay, so several here. Why would you want to do it if there's a high rate of failure?
The chance that you win is like greater than the chance that you
win. So you're hoping you're going to beat the odds.
Yeah, exactly.
Despite the fact of what the odds are.
Yeah, it's like the lottery.
A lot of rewards get to make change. You're not just...
a little more aspirational. We're going to go and be able to change the world, and that's what you're trying to go and do.
I want to see if the concept works. I'm curious on the success of a certain idea.
Okay, so the way that you go and test it is by going and risking your life, your family, and everything else just to go and be able to see if it's going to work.
I mean, after certain stages, yeah.
Okay. You're the outlier. You're better than everyone else. Okay, so this is getting a bit into the entrepreneurial mindset and why there is that high rate of failure. Looking on the rosy side, going and only paying attention to the when I conquer the world and not realizing that it's a big if. And so this is one of the things that we have to go and be able to understand. But essentially, we just go and shove to the back of our minds the fact that there is a high rate of failure and say, we're going to go and conquer the world. That's at its core how we go and deal with it. At least that was my mindset until I saw a paper that came out now a little more than 30 years ago that completely changed my mindset and then set the tone for the last 20 years of what I've been doing. That paper was going, it was a guy who became a colleague of mine at Harvard Business School, an economist named Bill Solomon. He was going and studying what was then very much an unknown black box, still is a little bit, of venture capital. Everyone's heard of venture capital? Okay. How many people know what venture capitalists do? Okay. Some of what we know today is because of this paper that he wrote. The title on the paper was, What Do Venture Capitalists Do? Question mark. Long paper going and laying out all the parts of their job. How do they go and get deals walking in the door that they can evaluate? How do they evaluate them? Once they're going and deciding which ones they want to invest in, how do they negotiate with those entrepreneurs? And then once they go and invest, how do they go and help build those companies? And so he's going and writing this long paper that he's going and exploring all of the parts of their job. Along the way, he fortunately thought to ask a critical question in terms of me as a tiny part of his paper. But he said, tell me about the parts of your portfolio, the companies you've invested in, that failed. Think about what these companies are and how high potential are these companies. Does anyone know what percentage of startups that are able to go and raise venture capital?
1%.
1%. These are the original 1%ers. They are the highest potential of these ventures. And yet, despite all that potential, it hit the dustbin of history because they failed. So that's what he was trying to go and look into, why that was. And he had his own ideas for what he was going to go and find. And indeed, they were pretty much matching what I would have thought also going into it, what we would come up with. The lingo was a little bit different back then. They didn't have sexy terms like we've developed since then. The core part of it, indeed, he found for a little bit more than a third of the reasons for failure. Things having to do with the product, missing the market, didn't coalesce. Today we call it product market fit issues. And so these are the kinds of things that he found. However, and this is just one line in the paper, one number in a table, he found one reason that completely swamped all the other reasons for failure. 65% of the reasons for failure were the people issues. The soft, knotty, subjective human problems. The Ben Adam Chavero, essentially, were what were the problems within these ventures. And when I saw that, that completely changed my mindset in terms of, we don't just go and shove that high rate of failure to the back of our minds and plow on. Let's go and identify those early decisions founders are making about who they involve in the venture, how they involve them, and see which are the ones that are going to go when they think it's going to heighten their potential, it actually goes and heightens their risks. That's going to have them think differently. Differently than when they're going and looking at the glory that they're going to have, only looking at the rosy scenario. Well, actually, let's go and have them think a little bit about it. It's not just to the right fork that you can go, but there might be a reason to think about the left fork. And so these are the things that I've now gone and spent the last 20 years identifying. When are you at a fork in the road where you're making that people decision? What are the options that you aren't considering seriously that you should think a little more deeply about? And what are the outcomes that each of these are likely to go and heighten? Could be heightening the risk of failure. Could be heightening the chance the team's going to blow up. Could be heightening that growth is going to be harmed. Or if they make other decisions, it could actually lead to that glory and potential and impacting the world. And so that's why I've gone and done a whole bunch of going and being able to go and understand these things and then start educating people about it. And so this is back, I started this in 2000. I then spent the next decade going and doing all of the research that goes and gets the data, goes and understands what are the ups, the downs, and how do we go and educate people about it. Then developed a course that was called Founder's Dilemma, as Ari was referring to it, to go and educate the next generation of founders about these issues. The second year of the course, back in 2010, I had a student who came by, as we were going through all of these founding problems, and he sat down in the seat across from me, standard office hours, I figured. Usually they want to go and grapple with their career dilemmas or their founding dilemmas and things like that. He looked me right in the eye, and he said, Noam, I'm never going to be a founder, but your course has already changed my marriage. At first, my inclination was just to apologize to him for snookering him into taking the wrong course, because that's not at all what we're doing in class. Second one, though, this is always an opportunity to go and learn. And so I asked, tell me more. Where are you coming from? Because I've been only focused in this box of founding, and you're telling me something is off here. He went and told me about how, as a young, newlywed, he was having all sorts of struggles with his co-founder of life. They were having problems being able to go and allocate roles within the couplehood. They were having trouble at these key inflection points that they are at right now, how to go and make decisions together. So he was saying that I was seeing things in class, even though this isn't directly applicable to my domain of, okay, it's outside of founding, let me go and import it into the marriage. And he's walking in the door and saying, honey, here's a difficult conversation that we've been neglecting to have, that no one forced us to go and practice in class. Let's go and see if we can go and resolve these issues that we've had or build our difficult conversation muscles together. Or, honey, there's a way that we saw that founders today were making decisions together. Let's go and try this out and see whether it works for us. And so he essentially completely burst me out of my focus in terms of the foundering is what I'm educating. This is an entrepreneurship course. And he said to me, No, this is a life course. This is much bigger in terms of the implications for it. And that's when I started appreciating that there's human issues, not just founding issues, and that there's all sorts of echoes that we're going to have across a lot of the other things that we're going and doing. There's one other thing that he brought to mind. So I had just finished writing my first book that I was referring to. Remember that back on page 99, I had gone and tapped, this is in a section called A Recurring Metaphor. We can learn something valuable by looking at founding teams in light of the first marriage described in the Bible. Getting into when God considered the ideal relationship between Adam and the spouse he is about to create for him. What's the phrase in the original Hebrew? What's the two words that Hashem captures the... Azer Kenegdo. I had gone and tapped the metaphor of Azer Kenegdo to be able to go and take a look at founding teams through that lens and the relationship they were supposed to go and have. And so once he had gone and broken me out of the blinders that I was in, I started seeing all sorts of ways in which my thinking about entrepreneurship had been informed by our Masorah. And I had this early vestige of it, of seeing that. I actually, second day of the semester, I bring this into class, being able to go and talk to them through that metaphor, be able to go and lay that out, and how there are all sorts of other echoes. Turns out that when I have in the board, this is just a footnote in that book, but when I'm talking about boards of directors, the size of the board, how they operate, what do you think I go and tap from our Masorah? First Mishnah in Sanhedrin. Talks about all the sizes of decision-making bodies. The common theme across all of those is they're all even-numbered. How do they go and operate? What is the odd-numbered? Thank you. They're all odd-numbered. What is the most common size of a startup board? Four people. Our Masorah taught us that is a bad decision to be able to go and do that. And so I go and tap it there a little bit in terms of that echo within it. But this helped us sort of shape the lens that I was bringing to the entrepreneurship issues. And so since then, I have gone and seen where we should be going and explicitly bringing all of these different pieces of what Chazal had gone and developed and what we've learned about to be able to go and have a unique lens on all of these dynamics. And so let's go now and shift gears into a little bit of tapping the Masorah. And we're going to see some of the leadership and entrepreneurship lessons that are going to emerge from it. Now, first off, going to go and tap above Metziah. This is from Pei Dalet. It's really easy to remember this one because Pei Dalet is Daf backwards. So you can just remember, any of you Daf people out there? This has become one of my favorite sugyas within the Gemara. What is the most famous, most iconic of the Chavrusas in the Gemara? Reish Lakish and Rabbi Yochanan. Okay, so this is from the sugya on the two of them. We're looking at founding teams, Chavrusa teams. Let's see if there's any lessons that we can get from it. It's going to be both Ben Adama Chavero and also Ben Adama Atzmo things that we might be able to go and take away from it. So first, I was going to cold call someone here, but it's a little far away, I guess, to go and read this. Nach Nafshe to Rav Shimon Ben Lakish. Okay, this is when Reish Lakish was Nifter. This long-time Chavrusa was Nifter. How did Rabbi Yochanan go and react to it? Very devastated by losing his chavrusa. So what did the chachamim go and do? They found a great replacement chavrusa for him. Who did they go and find? Rav Elazar ben Pedas. Very good. Who is Rav Elazar ben Pedas? Who is he? Just a guy off of the street? Gadol Hador. So just anyone who's doing daf. Towards the end of Nida, we have Rav Zera saying, Halavai that I could go and learn directly from Rav Elazar ben Pedas. That I could go and be able to drink in his wisdom directly. This is the Gadol Hador that they're going to replace him with. Sound like a good solution? Okay. This is hopefully Rav Yochanan can keep getting to a new Vadrega by having a new Chavrusa and being able to go and do it. Well, unfortunately, he was devastated. Because what came out of the Chavrusa with Reish Lakish? What did he used to do?
He used to refute him.
24 darts that he can throw at everything that Rabbi Yochanan said. How do we feel when we get criticism? Does that feel good to us?
Nope.
No.
Ego.
Pretty devastating. That's the kind of thing that we go and try to avoid. And yet, Rabbi Yochanan saw it. Rabbi Yochanan saw it as something that was critical for his being able to go and get to another Madrega. And so what happened? He's getting this new Chavrusa in here. And what is he expecting? Expecting more of what he had that had gone and honed him into a Gadol Hador. And instead, what did he get?
He was getting support.
He got support, Messiah. Everything that he used to say, Tanya de Messiah. I can go and cite a Brisa, Mishnah, that can go and be able to support you. And so Rabbi Yochanan was devastated by that. This is, what are the kinds of things that we might take away from this in terms of lessons? What are we going to see about this? Okay, so the yes man being a problem, even though it's the most comfortable thing for us. Now we have to go and seek the naysaying, go and seek the people who are going to be able to go and push us to a greater level.
Diligence.
Diligence?
Or a diligent thing. Like you said something that's good, but how are you going to deal with these 24 issues and that?
Okay, so essentially, it's just showing a little bit of balance here between them.
Yeah.
Okay? So, this is one of the things that is not natural to us. And this gets back into the founding mindset. We saw on display, it was great. The natural inclination that we have to look at the rosy. The natural inclination here to go and seek the agreement. The natural inclination to find people who are going to go and buck us up. Some of these things are the things that we have to go and counter. That we have to go and work against. In order to be able to go and get even better. If we can go and make sure we're looking at the pitfalls, not just the rosy, if we're looking for the throwing the darts at us instead of the Messiah lay, if we can go and make sure that all of these things are things that we can go and identify our own biases and then be able to go and work against it, this is where we have throughout the Gemara. Chazal understood human nature better than anyone else. And this is where we can go and be able to see the examples that we should go and take from it in terms of the ways in which we should be going and importing into our daily lives. And so if you're at work and you get criticism, this is where we have to go and retrain ourselves not to recoil or fire back, but to go and welcome it and think a little bit more deeply about how this is going to go and help us raise our game rather than that natural inclination of this is how it feels. that this is how we go and react in terms of being devastated by that. In terms of that, we can also go and see some ways in which, if we step back to Bracius, to go and compliment a little bit about the Bava Metzia, that we already talked about, you said, the Ezer Kenego side of it. What does Rashi say about Ezer Kenego? Zacha, if you are meriting it, it will be an Ezer for you. If you are not Zoha, then you get the Kenego. What does it say about the Kenego? Do we go and welcome that? No, we're not Zoha, and we get the pushback. That, to me, captures human nature really well. As Rashi is going, in some ways, laying it out, we can get into whether it's prescriptive or descriptive in terms of what he's saying. But to me, that captures the recoiling that we have from when we get that pushback. Far better, to me, of capturing this is what the Netziv says. Anyone familiar with what the Netziv says on this? And the Netziv says that the Kenegdo is the Ezer. This is matching Rabbi Yochanan. That by getting the pushback, that's what helps us raise our game. And this is where we have to go and retrain ourselves, not to take the natural Rashi approach to life and that mindset, but instead to also go and retrain ourselves to be like more than the Netziv. So this is where we're going and seeing echoes, both from Bereishis and from Bava Metzia, of being able to go and have that mindset be different for ourselves. There's actually some academic research. We get into some more recent stuff. Any musicians here? None? Okay. Got one partial musician? Okay, which would you guess plays better? An orchestra that gets along well, or an orchestra where there's a bit of tension?
Of course we get along well.
Where they get along well.
My brothers play together.
That what?
Me and my brothers play together.
Okay, and of course you guys always get along well.
Of course, yes.
Okay, so bad news. There was some research done on what they call grumpy orchestras. And it's the grumpy orchestras, the ones that have a bit of tension within them, that actually play better than the kumbaya orchestras, than the ones where everyone is all getting along together. Because they're pushing each other, there's a little bit of the competitiveness, a bunch of the ways in which they're able to go and raise their game beyond if it was everything is going smoothly for us. So that's one example. There's actually one, I just love this as an image, and also it gives us an example of it, also with having a brother here. These are the Harrison brothers. These are world-class bodybuilders. And what they credit, these are twins, they credit their success as that they are going and pushing each other. What we see visually here, that because they are going and raising their game by competing against each other, they get even better than they would have if they didn't have a twin. And so the same kind of thing of going and seeing the kinecto that we see visually here as being able to go and improve things for us. So if you go and think through it, where do we go and experience going and raising our game? So a bit in terms of the in the base medrash, when you're in that chavrusa there, go and find that chavrusa. Maybe go and have a way in which you go and deputize each other to go and push back against each other. If the chavrusa is going a little bit too smoothly, maybe step back and say, how can we go and get better by pushing each other? Are we getting a little bit too ungrumpy as a chavrusa? Let's go and see if there's, give me one way I can be a better chavrusa. Maybe once a month or so with your chavrusa, go and step back and go and make sure that you're not just going and succumbing to the azer and the ease of that, but find where you can go and foster the kinecto with each other. Okay? Other ways, I'm not going to go and suggest that you go and pick a fight once a month. You're going to be able to go and have your Ashes Chayil go and push back on you. But there are some times that I will go with my wife and we'll go and say, how could we have done that better? When I went, she doesn't come to my talks too often, but when she comes to my talks, she's learned that. What's my first question going to be? Okay. What should I do differently next time? And she started doing vice versa for it. She actually brought an issue that she was facing at work to me and said, what did I do wrong here? And this is where you're going and legitimizing and helping each other in ways that otherwise, if we're all easier, we're all going to be the poorer for it. So these are just examples there about where we should be going, finding that helping hand that's going to help us scale to greater heights. If we can go and be able to retrain ourselves to not go and be succumbing, to only be doing the Azer side of it. Okay, so in terms of this, the Kenegdo piece, that we go and appreciate that. Let's go and take another thing from the Gemara in terms of now in our mindset and how we go and be able to take the negatives of life and be able to go and get better. Anyone think of another realm in the Gemara where we went and saw that you can go and get better, or at least keep yourself, when there's a negative that happens, that you retrain yourself? What would we go and think might be an example?
Rabbi Akiva and his dad.
Rabbi Akiva and?
His father-in-law.
Okay. Oh, that's interesting. So, That's what Kalasa Vua, how we went and recrafted a relationship. So that's an interesting one. Rabbi Akiva, great example. So where else do we see Rabbi Akiva? Okay, so going and rebuilding the five Talmidim that came from the ashes out of that. These are all examples of how Rabbi Akiva had a very different mindset compared to how we usually react to failure. What was the mindset that he had, and where did it come from? Does anyone know who his Rebbe was? Nachum Mishkamzu. Gamzu Latova. He went and developed in Rabbi Akiva a very different mindset compared to when you go and have devastating setbacks like these ones that we've talked about. That you go and find a way of keeping yourself in the game, having the emuna that is going to be a Gamzu Latova. I'm going to ask you, and this is where we can go and think about it from an entrepreneurial perspective, that we should go and actually try to outdo Rabbi Akiva in terms of that mindset. Let's go and take a little bit through the path and see some of the ways where we might be able to go and do it. And so in terms of this, it's going from Brachos Samech. So those of you in the daf, hang in there. Less than 2 months and you're going to be able to go and get to this part of it. Okay, so what's the classic example? Do people know what the story over there was about Rabbi Akiva?
The chicken and the thing and guides.
Okay, so he's trying to get to where? He's trying to get to a town. He gets there, and there's no housing for him. So he is stuck now outside the town in the dark. How would we feel if we went through that? Would you be feeling good about no one can welcome me in, and I'm now getting stuck in a field outside of town? Does that feel good? No, but what did he add? What did he been retrained to go and be thinking? Gamzu Latova. And so he keeps himself there. Hey, at least I have my companionship. Got my donkey. I'll have my candle. That'll keep me in the game in terms of being able to give me some light in the darkness and companionship among the loneliness.
And a rooster.
Okay, and rooster also. Okay, and dark comes. What's the first thing that happens when dark comes? Okay, a wild animal goes and kills the last vestige of companionship. Then what comes along? The wind comes and blows out the candle. Devastation after devastation. And what's Rabbi Akiva's reaction? Gamzu Latova, each step of the way. Very admirable in terms of the emuna. Keep yourself in the game. For entrepreneurs, this is the darkest of days, is almost literally, but the darkest of days for them when the whole world is crashing in on them. How do they keep themselves in the game? How do they get through the bottom of the roller coaster? The Gamzu Latova mindset. Hang in there, persist. The entrepreneurial persistence, what people go and point to, is what separates the greats from the others. So this is what Rabbi Akiva had gone and perfected in terms of that. And then what happened when finally the dawn came after he keeps himself in the game? What does he see? The town had been destroyed. That would have been me. And only now can I go and appreciate why, yes, this was a Gamzu Latova. So I'd actually push you to go and think about how you can get even better at being able to go and do this, because we actually have to become not just full of emuna like Rabbi Akiva was, but we have to be able to go and become shutfim with Hashem, become partners with Hashem to make it a Gamzu Latova. If we can go and seize on those downturns in our lives and be able to go and push ourselves to maybe rethink some of the things that we're doing that otherwise we would not have rethought it. At a student paper almost a decade ago, there was one line in it that I just went and put up on my wall after staring at it for 10 minutes. That line was, it's really easy to get stuck in a rut, especially if you're good at what you do. If we are good at what we're doing, we're just going to stay on autopilot. We're just going to keep going down that same road. And it's only when the Eibishter goes and sends us a lightning bolt, forcing us to go and rethink what we are doing, that we go and realize that we were in a rut, that there might be a higher impact way we can go and be living our lives, that there's a way in which shifting gears might be a plus. And so to the extent that we can go and see these opportunities when something negative hits, let's go and rethink, let's go and get stronger from it because we're not on autopilot anymore. That's just one example of how we can go and seize on the setback to be able to go and become a partner with Hashem, do our Hishtadlus, to make it into a Gamzu Latova. So let me just go and take, in terms of we've been moving back and forth between the Masorah and the modern framing. Has anyone read the book Anti-Fragile? Anyone familiar with that concept? This is by the author of The Black Swan. This is his follow-up to it. Okay? This goes back to also a little of my engineering beginnings, being able to go and relate to the concepts there. What is a fragile system? Fragile system is one. What happens when you hit a bump in the road if it's a fragile system? Collapses. Okay? What do we go and aspire to go and do? Be able to go, we hit a bump in the road, we can persist through it. A neutral system, one that can keep going with it. What do you think an anti-fragile system would be?
A tank.
Okay, that what?
A tank.
That improves it. The system gets better because of the setbacks. Can anyone think of any anti-fragile systems that you run into? It's a little bit of a hard concept. Are there ways that we... Your immune system. How is your immune system?
Learns from viruses and create antibodies and everything.
Okay, so in your... What are you doing when you go and put a... When you get an antibody in your system? You're assaulting your immune system. Why would you go and assault your immune system? Because you're going to make it stronger. Hashem went and created our immune systems that when they get a test in the small, it's actually then able to go and handle things in the big a lot better. So a great biological example, very close to home. Any other biological examples people can think of? That what?
Working out.
What are you doing when you work out?
You're breaking down the muscle fibers, which causes them to grow bigger.
You're tearing your muscles. Why are you doing that?
I manage your fitness company.
Okay, very good. So this is the ad for you right here on the screen. Okay, you're going and ripping your muscles because Hashem designed them to get stronger. And, sorry to add this one verse, but your immune system with the antibodies that we are going and injecting in order to go and get stronger from it. This is where we have that Hashem took setbacks to go and design an anti-fragile body for us to be able to go and get even better at it. Now, I don't think they've come out with a Hebrew version of it yet. So I took the liberty of being able to go and suggest a title for when he does. This is essentially the Gamzu L'Tova book about how you go and take the setbacks and get stronger from them. And so this is something to go and retrain ourselves also, and not the recoiling, not the face down on the keyboard when we go and hit a bump in the road, but instead being able to go and appreciate how we can go and get stronger from it. Some ways we can use the metaphor of boot camp. When you're in the army here, when you're doing boot camp, are you fighting a real war? No, what are you going and doing instead?
Fighting yourself.
You're doing something in the small. You're going and honing your ability to deal with the setbacks and the challenges of war. For when the big one comes, you'll be even stronger for it. And so we have to find ways to be able to go and have the boot camp of life. Be able to go and find the small ways that we can practice the Gamzu L'Tova mindset, seizing on it, and then being able to go and get stronger from it. Tiny little example. So my kids, there was one time that we were late to school. We're driving. We hit a red light. How does that feel? If you're desperate to get somewhere and you hit a red light. Okay, a bit frustrated, things like that. What do you think, though, is the first question that I went and asked my kids?
How can we avoid it next time?
Okay, so how can we get stronger? We're in a rut of getting out a little bit late. Maybe this is a way to go and shock us into rethinking a little bit of that. Okay, so that would be a very good, proactive way to go and do that. My question was a little less creative than that. How could this be a Gamzu L'Tova? And one of my kids pointed out that a car had just gone and barreled through the intersection and might have hit us. I wouldn't have thought of that. That wasn't what I was meaning in terms of the question. But we're retraining them a little bit. They were a little bit frustrated of being a little bit late for school. This is a way that we can go and have in the small of life, the boot camps, be able to go and have it be when it's bigger and we get hit by a bigger setback, that we've gone and trained ourselves to be able to go and have that mindset be a little better. And so this is where if we can go and take that as the way that we can go and practice, find the excuses to go and practice it a little bit. Talk to my kids a little bit when you get a, don't do that well on a test. What is the inclination? You just go and bury it, you don't want to take a look at it. Or what do you go and focus on? Which questions? The ones you got right. Well, what should they be going and focusing on? Take a look at one of the wrong ones that you were in a rut about. We were talking about this on Shabbos, that I still remember when I was in the Chidon HaTanach, the question I got wrong. I don't remember the 49 questions I got right, but that one stuck with me because I now learned from it. And so all of these ways that if we go and refocus ourselves on the X's of life, not the check marks of life, where we can go and get stronger and have a lot longer learning when it comes to that. Okay, so next one in terms of the Masorah, in terms of being able to go and tap them. This is, for people doing Daf right now. Okay, this is Daf Dalad. This is from Brachos Daf Dalad. In terms of this, so what's going on here? Talk us through it.
When David HaMelech said to HaKadosh Baruch Hu that he's a chassid because the other kings woke up at 3 hours after Alei Shachar and he was
Okay, but what does he go and point to? So he says, what does he go? I need Nimlach Mephibosheth Rabbi. I go, and what do I do to Mephibosheth? I ask him to do what?
Insulted Mephibosheth on all his all those psalkim.
So this is the melech going and asking him for questions, asking questions to him. And what is he seeking? He is seeking pushback. He is seeking all sorts of ways that Mephibosheth is going to tell him where he's wrong. And this is the prominence of a melech going and doing that. And then, actually, it's not Mephibosheth that is his name, Ella Ishbosheth. Why is it Ishbosheth? Why was he called that? Sheyame vayesh pnei David be'alacha. He went and embarrassed David, and that's how David got better. That's how David was able to go and become the great that he was, by going and seeking the negative. And so this is where you can go and see, ripped out of brachos, I guess we got the three B's, ripped out of brachos, ripped out of bracious, and ripped out of Baba Kama, Baba Matzia, being able to go and see in our Masorah how it's going and reinforcing it for ourselves. Okay, and also, this is right now from the parsha that we just finished. So we have Yaakov Avinu with the brachos that he's going and giving in Vayechi. It said, the pasuk says that Ishashir Berachato Berachotama. Yaakov went and gave the brachos to all of his sons. Did he give brachos to all of his sons?
Shimon and Levi.
Also Reuben even. They got negative. So how can we go and say that that's a bracha? How would we say that they had? He was giving them the constructive side that here's how you can go improve, be able to go and have all of your progeny be able to go and understand a little bit of how they have to go and counteract some of these natural inclinations. And so right there from the parsha also, we see the ways in which if it's taken in the right way, these can become brachas. These can become schuyos rather than being the negative if we're going and seeing them as the pushback from it. Okay, so that's a couple of the things in terms of the biases. Let's just get into the final one in terms of the way in which we have to go and counter some of the things that are very natural. And this is going to be it's going to sound like a bit of a bizarre academic term. So we're going to see that there's actually some universalisms in terms of the ways in which the human psyche works. It's called homophily. Anyone know what homophily is? Okay, homophily is when birds of a feather flock together. The natural inclination for you to stick to the people who are the most comfortable for you are the most like you. Think about your five closest friends. Are they more different from you, or are they more similar to you? How many people say that they're more similar to you? Okay, how many people say they're more different from you? Okay, so dominantly, that it's the similarity that brings us together. It's very understandable in the social realm. Very understandable. Next time you're in a group with your friends, take a look and see if they're dressed the same as you. How many black pants, white shirts there are, or other things like that. It's one indication. Sometimes in class, I go and put up a couple of pictures of NFL coaches. They're all dressed in blue shirts and khakis in that picture there. You can go and see all sorts of other ways that we can go and that's just at the surface level, but it's a little bit of an indication of that. And so in terms of that, what homophily is, it, the people who look like you, those are the ones you want to go and hang out together with. And so it's very much understandable, especially in the social realm, that you're going and seeing the way in which you're brought together with that. Is that a good team? Doesn't that value because of what? Okay, they think just like me, which is Rebbe Elazar ben Pedas, Messiah-like to everything that you say, the yes men who are coming together to be able to go and do it. Within a founding team, do you think it's good for them to have that? Is that what?
The team. You've got the skill yourself.
Okay, so if you have it, don't go and add them onto the team. There are a bunch of other ways in which it's going to cause tensions and things like that. In terms of a study of small businesses, it's going to take a look at just some results from academia. They went and thought this is going to be that founding teams are built to have a build and a sell. Someone's going to go and create the product. Someone's going to go out and get it out there. Instead, they found much more of the homophily in tremendous ways. It's racial homophily, gender homophily, all of these ways. That what?
And successful founding businesses?
Any businesses that are going and founding. And so they found that these teams, in terms of that composition, tremendous ways in which they're doing that. Also, a lot of the ways in which the networks they were building, not just the knowledge they were going and building, that they were going to be all very much having the similar networks in terms of that. There's some research that's been done on the strength of weak ties, the strength of tapping the people who are right by you, who don't look very much similar to you. And so we go and take a look at that, a bunch of the ways in which we have to go. It's early, it's easy, it's comfortable. But over time, a lot of the skill sets are going to be redundant, the mindsets and things like that. This is the cost of succumbing to the same people around us, succumbing to the Rebbe Elazar ben Pedas problem, where we're going and doing it. And so let me just give you an example of how we can go in life and be able to go and counter that. There's a founder named Tim Westergren. Tim was a musician. A bunch of things he accumulated in his background. Lead singer for a group called Yellowwood Junction. Band manager. Sound good? accumulating all the things you need to be able to go and do as a founder, budget management, computer editing of music, and things like that. When he was going and taking a look at how he's going to go and build a company, he got an idea for what he called the Music Genome Project. He had suffered as a musician. How do I go and find people who are going to be able to discover my band? How are they going to be able to go and find the music that they like, and I'm one of those? And so he decided, let's go and break down music into the genome of the music. Let's go and find ones that are similar to it, learn what people like, and show them music that is similar that they'd never find otherwise. Say he's going and founding this online music company. How should he go and be thinking about it? What do you think is going to be the first person he's going to go and talk about this idea with?
Fellow musician.
Fellow musician. Someone just like me. The ones right around there. Is he going to get much pushback from that person? Is he going to get the Kinecto or anything like that? No. Very unlikely that he's going to get that from that person. And also, what's going to lead to in terms of who's going to be most likely to go and co-found it? That person. So we go and break it down. This is how we have to go and think about it as a check on it. We go and take, what do you have to do and succeed? Well, online music company. You need music expertise. You need a techie, the online part of it, to be able to go and do it. And you need someone who's got the business experience. If we're going and succumbing to Omophily, if we're going and succumbing to the Azair part, Tim can go and check this off. And who's the most likely other co-founder he's going to go and get? The fellow musician. So this is what his founding team is going to look like. Would you go and invest in this? Everyone here in Israel wants to be a venture capitalist. Would you be a VC that would go and invest in this?
No.
No, there's two things that are wrong here. The double check box is going to lead to what?
Fights.
Fights, conflict. And the unchecked box is going to lead to?
Zero progress.
Gaping holes, major problems of making progress, things like that. So we have to think through the checklist of life that you want to go and create. You have to go and counter this natural inclination that all of us have about feeling much more comfortable in people who are just like us. Instead, you create your checklist. I take care of this. Now let me go and find the weak ties, the people who are right by me, who can be able to go and find a business person. Tim fortunately went and found a guy named John Kraft, a serial entrepreneur, who could go and plug that in for him. And then the two of them went and found a CTO named Will, a whiz who was going to be able to go and do the technical side. It's only because he pushed himself beyond the Azair that he was able to go and make sure this is a company that turned into Pandora Radio. So pioneer within the online music industry. If it had been just Tim or Tim and his musician friend, he would have succumbed and he wouldn't have been able to go and train and change that industry in the ways that he did. So this is just a few of the ways that we see through the roller coasters of life. Delve into a little bit the biases, the inclinations, the ways in which Arbus Sora can go and help us understand how we have to be able to go and counter it. We can proactively think through these issues before we go through this roller coaster ride, go through the boot camp to go and build those skills, whether it's at home going and building the Azair Kinecto skills together, whether it's the ways in which you're going to be able to go and understand your mindset to only look at the rosy and not prepare for the failures, go and take the failures in the boot camp of life to get stronger from it, and also understand how we have to go and push ourselves, be able to go and find the Kinecto and the unchecked boxes on our checklist. And hopefully as you're doing that, as you're going through groups like this, finding the support and the knowledge that you can, hopefully be able to go scale the heights of the Golan and be able to go and celebrate together as you get up that mountain. Okay, so thank you guys so much for coming. Thank you very much.